Phil Williams. It's hard to go wrong when you're on the right side. Right Side Radio. Solid, conservative, and just plain right.
News Talk 770 AM, 92.5 FM, WVNN, Phil Williams, Right Side Radio, solid, conservative, and just plain right. Hey, moving now to number two in the Triple Dipper, Ukraine. What now? What next? So, yeah, a lot of things have happened. This is a fluid environment, all right? Things are happening, like, literally by the minute. I'm sitting here watching the screen, knowing full well that I'm seeing things that are somewhat new. They get some rehash in the story, obviously, but right now the British ambassador is talking about the fact, you know, that things on the ground are what they are and that there's new developments. So here's a couple things for you to know, and then I do want to play some clips. Copper, you let me know when you got those clips that I've got on the board for you ready. So first of all, understand this. It's not getting better, first of all. Now, there are places where it still appears that there is a level of confusion, lack of leadership, perhaps some logistical issues within Russia's forces, all right? Up around Kyiv, which is the capital city, and if you're looking at the map, it is kind of north-central, slightly off to the northwest. And Kyiv being the capital is the prize. That's the one that Russia wants. They need that capital city because they have to dethrone, if you will, they have to dethrone the existing Ukrainian leadership, because Zelensky's a hero to the world right now, much less, I mean, even more so his own people. But they've got to get rid of Zelensky. So, and they've got to capture the capital. That's where the seat of government is, and they're going to need to put in their puppet government, the Russians are. So one of the things they're trying to do right now is get to Kyiv. Well, right now, that push appears to be stalled. And we're hearing a variety of reasons. And now, you know, keep in mind, too, we've got intel assets that are available. I don't know. I mean, there's different kinds of intel. You've got what they know as SIGINT. SIGINT being signals intelligence, intercepts, you know, signals intercepts, trying to gather things through online capabilities, internet. So SIGINT is certainly ongoing. We've got HUMINT, which I guarantee we have a lot of HUMINT through Ukrainians, but less so through our own resources. But HUMINT is human intelligence, and that's where you have eyes on, all right? Somebody has eyes on the situation and is able to tell you what they're seeing. They're developing that contact, they're developing that moment, they're putting, you know, eyes on the enemy at the moment and getting that back to you. And then on top of that, you've got other things like satellite intelligence and imagery, and they can see this convoy. Well, it's just sitting there. And the mixed bag of intel that we've got on it says a variety of things. There's speculation, which I guess they have to spitball it, they have to war game it a little bit. There's speculation that right now the push towards Kyiv is in the waiting pattern as they wait for the forces fighting in the south to complete their portion and then cut northwards. That's one theory that strategists are saying maybe that's what's up. The other is we're hearing their logistical trains are messed up. They don't have gas and food for that convoy, and they have outpaced their ability to, you know, do the log runs, the log supply, for those forces. I don't know. The other is, I heard one report last night that said that there are intel sources saying that much of the vehicles coming in on that convoy that came through Belarus in the north were from an undertrained army of conscripts, many of whom did not service their vehicles prior to moving the through the line of departure, and that they had, you know, tires and maintenance issues that are falling apart on them on the road. I don't know. Maybe it's all the above. Either way, the big push into the capital appears to be still stalled and in place, and no one can really put their finger on why. I did also see, by the way, one update is that the Ukrainian Air Force is still in the air, and they are taking out portions of that convoy now. Glad to hear it. News is not so good for the Ukrainians down in the southern end. All right, on the Black Sea, Russians want the Black Sea port of Odessa. They have moved through. I told you yesterday they seized the city of Kherson, and Kherson being the next major, the next nearest city to Odessa. Odessa is a prize, all right? Odessa is a warm water port city, a city of well over a million citizens, if I'm not mistaken, with major port facilities on the Black Sea. Russians want that. That also cuts off supply lines from the sea for Ukraine. Now, story on hotair.com. I mean, literally one of the best I have seen in terms of summarizing where things are. In fact, what was really interesting is this particular article quotes retired Major General Peter Corelli, who was the division commander when I was in Baghdad. I've got pictures of me and General Corelli meeting with the mayor of Baghdad. And I sent one to Birdman. It'll probably be up on the website later on because I thought, you know what, if General Corelli's in the news, I'll go ahead and post that picture just for grins. But hotair.com, dated last night, gave one of the best updates I've seen of where we are in this current stage of the war. And it's pretty intense. I told you about the Russian military convoy outside Kyiv, and that's like stalled out for 3 days now, which is just boggling the generals' minds. Down in the south, like I said, they are making some gains. Meanwhile, over in the east, Kharkiv in the northeast remains under Russian attack, and the battle plan now, it seems, is for Russian forces to try and split eastern Ukraine from the west. If they can secure Kharkiv in the northeast and Mariupol in the southeast, and then move over towards taking Odessa, what they will then have is a complete land bridge across the east and lower portions, southern portions of Ukraine, which gives them the ability to traverse that part of the country free of attack, or at least, you know, free of major resistance. So that's all going on even as we speak right now. Now, listen, General Corelli, my former boss, General Corelli, and it points out, he was a veteran of the Iraq insurgency. Yes, he was. We were in Baghdad in 2004. I was out on the Battalion 5, but I had to keep going to this certain thing that we were working on that General Corelli took a personal interest in. So I wound up interacting with him quite a bit. But General Corelli, he commanded the 1st Cavalry Division during the major Shia uprising of 2004. And he points out that at the time it was estimated that roughly 15% of the millions of people who lived in Baghdad wanted to kill U.S. troops. He says Kyiv is going to be a far different situation for Russian troops because they face near universal resistance. It's not like 15% or so hate the fact that we're here. No, they all hate the fact that you're here. A city of 3 million people, a city bigger than Chicago. And he says right here, he says, you're going to move into a city of 3 million people, General Corelli says, and not one of them is going to come to your aid. He said, what a lot of people are not understanding is how much urban combat just sucks up your manpower. Corelli says that as Putin's frustration grows with his military setbacks, so will his ruthlessness. And already there's ominous reports about what's been happening in that regard. So there's that. Now, let me just step aside for a second and tell you about the needle that we have to thread here. All right, so this whole section is called What Now, What Next? Well, General David Petraeus was on Fox just this morning. And the clip was worth playing. It was about an 8-minute clip. I'm not going to do that, obviously. But Copper Clip 3, let's go ahead and get that. Clip 3 is General David Petraeus talking about, in my words, the needle that we actually have to thread to try and figure out what to do to stop Putin. And I'll talk more about that when we get done. Go ahead and play Clip 3.
Are you arguing that we should put in place a no-fly zone in Ukraine, or at least part of Ukraine, as Kurt Volker was arguing just an hour ago?
Yeah, I don't know that I'm ready to go there just yet, Martha, but I'm certainly thinking about it in the back of my mind. Again, we're all trying to come up with other ideas. There may be some options in the world of covert action that I'm not going to get into here that might possibly be employed in this situation. There may be some other ideas that can emerge. I'm very conscious of the challenges of those sitting around the Situation Room table who are confronted on the one hand by this terrible barbarity, and on the other hand by a concern that we would bring our country into, again, what President Biden has termed World War III.
How seriously do you take Vladimir Putin's escalation of even discussion about the use or putting at a higher alert level nuclear weapons? Do you believe that he would use them?
Well, I mean, no one can know what he would do. And the question is, do you want to get into a game of poker with him, if you will? I mean, do you want to try to guess what he would be willing to do? And I don't think he knows what he would be willing to do until the moment arrives.
All right, you can stop it there. All right, so, yeah, I mean, the reality is that we are in a situation where we're trying to predict what some say is a madman's next moves. Others say is just a cold, calculating, ruthless individual. Some say it's a little bit of both. I would say it's a little bit of both. That being said, final word from that article I told you about in hotair.com dated yesterday is the fact that one of the most ominous details about the... Well, let me back up. President Putin had a phone call with the president of France, Emmanuel Macron. All right? And so Macron tells the world afterwards, this is only going to get worse. After a 90-minute phone call, he came away completely discouraged by it and said, this is only going to get worse. The other ominous detail that I did not know until I read this article today from hotair.com, it says the most ominous detail here is that it was Putin who called Macron, not vice versa. If Macron had initiated the call, it would have been a plea for peace. But with Putin initiating the call, the purpose was almost certainly to warn the West of escalation. Meaning what happened was Putin was getting ticked off because he feels like people are getting in on his business, which they are, rightfully so. And he was trying to tell the world to back off in a 90-minute phone call with one of the leaders of the West. All right, Copper, take us to a break. We'll come back from that. I got more on this because this is the biggest story of the decade, folks. It affects all of you green suitors out there at Redstone Arsenal, the folks over to the east of us in the Anderson Army Depot, and down south in Maxwell Air Force Base, and certainly down at Fort Rucker. But it also affects our defense contracting, and it affects so many of us who are also paying a higher price at the pump and seeing the other tangential second and third order effects of what's going on. All big doings, and we'll keep on discussing it for a bit more. Number two, Ukraine. What now? What next? We'll talk about it when we get back. News Talk 770 AM, 92.5 FM, WVNN, Phil Williams, Right Side Radio, solid conservative, just plain right. Time now, 3:23 p.m., continuing with number two on the Triple Dipper, Ukraine, what now and what next? I've got a caller on line four, so I'll go ahead and grab that. Brian from Huntsville. Hey, Brian, Phil Williams on Right Side. How you doing?
Doing well, and I hope you are blessed as also.
I am, sir. Thank you.
Odessa and everything, that was what Germany wanted in World War II to a point, because there were a lot of oil fields not too far from the area in that warm water port, relatively. That was a source of oil for them. And right now, even today, Odessa has a pipeline going up to Poland, and that's how Ukraine makes a lot of their money, is selling off that oil. No wonder the Russians want it.
Yeah, it's the jewel of the Black Sea. I mean, it's literally... It's a huge population center. It's got lots of infrastructure, and you're correct, it's got energy infrastructure and the warm water port. I mean, it's a big prize.
Not Black Sea, but black gold.
There you go. Yeah, great point, Brian. Appreciate you, man. Thanks for calling in. Yeah, that's great perspective. He's right. There's a lot that sort of feeds Ukraine, if you will, out of Odessa. They have a lot of their import-export capability, their energy infrastructure, and their ability to import goods necessary for the survival of the people, all in one place. I mean, not just that one place, but certainly in that place, in Odessa. One of the other things that I did not know until most recently is that the nation of Ukraine is oftentimes considered the breadbasket of Eastern Europe. It is a huge agricultural center. And something like, I want to say 20 to 25% of the grain in Europe comes out of Ukraine. And that may be, I may have that number incorrect, but I believe it was very, very high. And so that is going to have a significant impact on other parts of Europe, as it's going to raise the cost of goods across the European continent. So there's that. Now, keep in mind, there's other aspects of the European continent at play right now. I'm looking at a map right now on the big screen here in the studio, and some of the other nations in and around Ukraine are going, whoa, hang on a second. All right, we're in. We want to be part of the UN. We want to be part of NATO. So Finland and Sweden are talking about NATO membership. Story I've got right here, and this came off of a, I didn't actually save the name on this printout. But this was from a international policy website. Georgia and Moldova, Georgia down to the southeast on the Black Sea, and Moldova over to the southwest, I believe, of Odessa. Anyway, they're both former Soviet republics too. Georgia and Moldova have formally applied this week. Have formally applied for European Union membership after their ambitions were accelerated in the shadow of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. It says the newfound initiative in the two countries where Russian troops are positioned in defiance of local international opposition follows Ukraine's decision to press its demands for EU membership. So basically, Ukraine said, yeah, you know what, while we're under attack, if you would please consider our application, we'd appreciate you expediting that. Well, Georgia and Moldova are saying the same thing. What's happening right now, the geopolitical landscape is changing in Europe. The geopolitical landscape is basically the alignments, the treaties, the negotiations, the dynamics of their interactive economies. All those things right now are morphing as we speak simply because of one madman who is taking his nation and thrusting his armies into another nation. And others around there, by the way, if you stop and think about it, in the history of the world, has appeasement ever worked? Has appeasement and you know, genuflection ever really worked in terms of keeping bad actors at bay? All it does is stall the inevitable. So when you see things like, well, we just don't know that we should recognize Ukraine as part of the NATO countries, we might provoke Russia. Well, how'd that work out? They were going to be provoked no matter what we did, apparently. I get a little concerned right now about the fact that we're still waffling on Taiwan. We don't want to recognize them. Might upset China. Well, I got news. China's an aggressor anyway. And I'm afraid that what we're going to wind up seeing very soon is China taking that hardline stance and coming across the Straits of Taiwan and seizing that island nation. We need to go ahead and just call Taiwan a nation. They are. Well, interesting things are happening too in terms of the overall dynamics of geopolitical landscapes. So right now, this is storyline out of Night Before Last. Strange bedfellows. Storyline off of All Israel News. The German chancellor, let that sink in. The German chancellor makes a quick trip to Israel and says, quote, we need to do everything possible to try and effect change in Ukraine. Germany entering into a compact with Israel. Germany, the country that in many ways, because of its actions, spawned the creation of Israel post-Holocaust. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz made his first official visit to the Jewish state since taking office in December at a geopolitically challenging time based on the invasion of Ukraine. Just this week, Germany also reversed an earlier decision in sending 1,000 anti-tank weapons and 500 Stinger missiles to Ukraine. And Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett said that during the chancellor's brief visit, the two nations agreed on a new strategic cooperation. That's an interesting dynamic, y'all. That is a true geopolitical shifting right there. You got member nations, nations seeking membership in the EU. You got non-NATO members wanting in NATO now. You've got Russian forces on foreign soil. You've got maps in Belarus that show that Moldova should be worried because it had arrows drawn across Moldova. You've got Germany making a strategic compact with Israel. Where do we go next? All right, more on that when I get back. Phil Williams, Right Side Radio. Solid conservative and just plain right. Number two on the Triple Dipper, Ukraine. What now? What next? We'll be right back. News Talk 770 AM, 92.5 FM, WVNN, Phil Williams, Right Side Radio, solid conservative, just plain right. We're still on number two of the Triple Dipper. Number one today was rolling the dice on Alabama's future. We talked extensively about the new gambling bill dropped in. We had my friend, former state representative Ken Johnson on to talk about that. We've been in number two now for about the last half hour. Ukraine, what now, what next? Folks, this is a dynamic environment. I mean, it changes by the minute in some cases. And then you'll have these long periods of stagnation, and then all of a sudden, boom, a flurry of activity. But there's also things that are boggling the mind on the geopolitical. I mentioned a minute ago about Finland, Sweden wanting to be a part of NATO, about Georgia and Moldova applying for admission to the EU. But one of the other things that's happening geopolitically is you got to look at the Balkans. All right, so the Balkans just to the north, I mean, this has been a restive area for a while. I mean, they're famously unstable, right? I've got an article here I pulled off of geopoliticalfutures.com just talking about the fact that the war in Ukraine literally means that the Balkans once again have to step up their game and be careful because they can easily get sucked in. There are you know, portions of the Balkans that still wind up being very factionalized down you know, ethnic lines. The Serbs and the Croats still don't always get along. And what we don't want to see are the Baltic states, you know, in some way being drawn into this fight because Putin decides he wants to reclaim those territories later on down the line too. Kosovo just recently asked the United States, according to this article, to establish a permanent military base in the country and to help speed up its integration into NATO. Ah, that's big doings. So there you got Kosovo looking for NATO membership and a permanent strategic basing by the United States there. The other thing that you have to look at geopolitically that makes no sense right now, and this is on us. This is on us. In fact, okay, it's so funny. It happens all the time. I'm looking at the big screen. I kind of turn my eyes to the to the left here in the studio. And there it is, White House under pressure over surging oil and gas prices. Yes, a big chunk of what we pay is because of your state legislature raising your gas tax. That's certainly a part of it. But that's not all of it. The gas is at $110 per barrel right now on the international market. Petroleum imports from Russia to the United States, though, set a record in Biden's first year. Storyline off of CNS.com, CNSnews.com, literally pointing out, folks, that in 2021, the first year of the president's of President Joe Biden's administration, we averaged monthly 670,000 barrels a day of crude oil and petroleum products. I'm flabbergasted by this. 670,000 barrels per day in Russian oil and petroleum products that the United States imported was up, by the way, from the previous year, 2020. And up, you know, further even now, probably. But the truth be told, we had moved ourselves to energy independence. And there's no reason why we can't just flip that switch and move back to it. We can go into what I think Charlene and I were watching last night. And I'm trying to think who it was that made the statement. It may have been General Kellogg, who said we need to move ourselves back to a World War II mindset of production. And just basically say, start the pumps, build the assets, cut off Russia. That's how they're paying for their war. 670,000 barrels a day in Russian oil. And the administration has resisted, even to today, is resisting the idea of cutting off the supply of Russian oil. Well, I don't get that at all. But listen, there's also a human factor built in here. On the what now and what next, Copper, you still good on clip two? Go ahead and highlight that for me on the board if you're good to go. Clip two, all right, good deal. We do have, it's very interesting, you know, we in the United, like for instance, we've got Ilhan Omar. I'm trying to think who else. She's in Congress, obviously. We had, of course, Arnold Schwarzenegger was the governor of California. He's a foreign, you know, foreign-born citizen. So it's not, you do not have to be, you know, you can be a naturalized citizen, is what I'm trying to say, and run for office. Ilhan Omar being one of the classic examples. However, another we've got is a Republican by the name of Congresswoman Victoria Spartz, and she is of Ukrainian origin. When you hear her in a moment, you'll hear her, you know, very noticeable accent. She's got a plea right now on the human factor to stop the invasion, to help do everything that we can to stop it. Let me just play that for you right now. Clip two, Copper. Go ahead and play Congresswoman Victoria Spartz.
This is a genocide of the Ukrainian people by a crazy man. I'll tell you a personal story. I have my grandma, she's 95. She is right now in the city of Chernihiv. And her daughter told her, they came into village with a heavy machine gun, killed almost every person in that village. And they're killing women and children. They do doing the bombs, vacuum bombs, carpet bombs. They are using illegal weapons. And I can tell you one thing. If we don't stop him there, he is not going to stop.
Joe Biden, are you listening?
All right, you can stop it there. That's the human factor. That is a U.S. congresswoman, but she's born and raised in Ukraine, a naturalized citizen of the United States. Her grandmother is still there. And she's telling you that her own family is talking about the decimation of their villages. We're not seeing all of it because we can't get press into some of the places, obviously. But the human stories that are coming out indicate that this is a ruthless war. This is not a war against the army of Ukraine. This is a war against the people of Ukraine. This is a war against the culture of Ukraine. Yesterday, one of the most notable stories that came out was there was some serious concern about it's actually the largest nuclear power plant in Europe, apparently. I mean, go figure. I mean, by the way, this is not some backwater country. This is the agricultural breadbasket of Eastern Europe. This is the country that has some of the greatest energy infrastructure, some of the greatest port infrastructure. This is a big deal country in Europe. This is the second largest country, I believe, in Europe. 42, 43 million people. The city of Odessa is over a million. The city of Kyiv, the capital city, is bigger than Chicago. Russian troops were attacking the largest nuclear power plant. I'm not going to try and pronounce it. Well, I'll try it anyway. Zaporizhia. I think it's a Zaporizhia nuclear power plant. Anyway, there was great concern last night because they were shelling a nuclear power plant, for God's sake. They were shelling the nuclear power plant at Zaporizhia, and buildings were catching fire. There was real concern at first. What did that mean? We did determine eventually, though, that it appeared that it was the administration buildings, not the actual reactors themselves. These reactors, by the way, because of, you know, Chernobyl and other incidents that have occurred, they have fail-safe cutoff switches. You can shut them down quickly. However, the burning of the power plant's administration buildings threw a shock into the world for several hours. But staff at the nuclear power plant got a message out. The staff is apparently being held hostage by Chechen mercenaries who are working for Putin's army. These guys are ruthless. And they say in their message out, they said, quote, they will be trying to mine the nuclear power plant in order to blackmail the whole of Europe. In other words, they're booby trapping a nuclear power plant with the intent. But this supplies a lot of energy to Eastern Europe. And they say that they're mining it for the purpose of blackmailing Europe. In other words, do what we say, or we'll create damages that would be ungodly, and that we might shut off power that many of you rely upon. I got a caller on line three. Let me grab that real quick. Sparky from Harvest. Hey, Sparky, Phil Williams on Right Side. How you doing today, man?
Hey, appreciate your show and your words. I tell you what, I feel like we're witnessing probably the most murderous, ruthless, evil acts I've experienced in my lifetime. But to the point of the Russian oil, you were on that earlier. When you think about it, who is profiting from their relationships with the people who are in charge of this Russian oil in the administration? How blatant and bold this administration's position on that is. And to the people who care about the climate and the danger of our producing oil on the climate, the U.S. has reduced carbon emissions 23% in the last 11 years. And does it matter to the planet who is producing the oil if this production of oil is harming the planet? You know, it doesn't even pass a common sense test that, oh, we're going to buy the oil from Russia and other places or Iran now. It doesn't matter if the oil is being produced and you claim it's harming the planet. It doesn't matter where it's produced. We can produce it cleanly and responsibly. And I'll shut up now.
No, you don't just shut up, Sparky. It's great points, you know, and you have to also look at, okay, if we're buying Russian oil, then technically we're financing a war. What's the carbon footprint of that war right now? What's the carbon footprint of the burning buildings?
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. And wait, yeah. let's also talk science of carbon. The last volcanic eruption over near Java, that produced enough carbon, more carbon than mankind has produced in the entire history of mankind. So, yeah, let's put things in perspective.
Yeah, and I heard a statement last night that I thought was very telling. Somebody, I'm trying to remember which show it was on, but they basically said all of these green activists that demand that we not produce our own oil, but that we're funding the war in Ukraine, they claim to care about humanity. They don't care a thing about humans. And that's I thought, what an amazing phrase that was.
It's a political and sociological stance. There's no substance behind these green activists other than, I think, sticking it to what they consider American rich oil barons, even if that makes us slaves to Saudi Arabian oil barons and Russian cartels. Forget about it.
Yeah, my wife says every day we're being held hostage. That's what she says. And hey, Sparky, great call, man. Appreciate you as always. Call back anytime. So listen, let me wind that up with a few more things. All right. So number one is this, that human count that he's talking about. Story here off the AP, dated yesterday, the refugee count has now topped 1 million. The refugee count of people trying to get out of Ukraine in order to get their, you know, women and children and elderly out of the way of the war is now over 1 million, according to the United Nations. So that's a significant exodus of people. One of the things that did happen, I will say this, that one of the things that did occur in the course of these, you know, talks, so-called talks between Ukraine and Russia, which I thought, what is there to talk about? Well, it didn't even think about this until I saw one of the reports. Yes, there are certain things to talk about, not the least of which is, as to all these refugees, they established what they refer to as safe corridors. They agreed upon safe corridors so that people can exit. And I'll be honest with you, I'm surprised I didn't think of that, because that is a part of my training. So aside from the infantry and, you know, the airborne and the ranger stuff and all that kind of thing, a part of my training was called civil affairs, and it dealt with dealing with civilians on the battlefield, not the least of which is humanitarian evacuation and basically refugee operations. And you have to establish those safe corridors. You have to steer the populace a certain ways to keep them out of the conflict. Otherwise, they become massive collateral damage. So there's that. One more thing I'll say before we go to the break. I thought this was interesting. I think I said on the air yesterday that with regards to that stalled 40-mile convoy of combat vehicles northwest of Kyiv, that I thought, you know what, if we had a flight of A-10 Warthogs, we could just decimate that and turn it into 40 miles of dust. And we could. Those things are tank busters. Well, there's an article on defensenews.com that caught my eye. And I don't know how realistic this is. It's probably not realistic. But here they are asking for help. And we're saying today that NATO officially and formally denied the request for a no-fly zone. So it's not going to happen, at least not right now. But he points out in this article, the author does, that we've got A-10 squadrons that are sitting in reserve that we could actually give the planes to Ukraine. He said, in his words, I don't know if it's true, he says pilot retraining is minimal. All that is needed is painting Ukrainian insignia and delivering the aircraft. This can be done in days. He said this is a decisive piece, and the A-10 was actually decided developed for the purpose of its gun systems stopping armored assaults in Europe. That's when it first came into being. And by the way, if you've ever been privy to watching an A-10 do a gun run, it's an awesome force. All right, Copper, take us to a break. We'll come back and move to next on the Triple Dipper. Veterans running for office. That's kind of a cool topic. Veterans running for office. And top of the hour, I got a guy named Jared Hudson, former Navy SEAL, calling in. He's running for sheriff. Yeah, running for sheriff down there in Jefferson County. We'll talk to him at the top of the hour. Phil Williams, Right Side Radio. Solid, conservative, and just plain right. You stand by. We'll be right back.